We're going to get into the nitty-gritty of that jobs report because the two surveys that go into it sometimes tell conflicting stories about the economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, December 3rd. Good to have you with us. Muddled is the word one of our producers used to describe today's jobs report from the Labor Department. Employers added less than half the expected number of jobs last month, just 210,000, but the number of unemployed people declined by 542,000. And the unemployment rate fell to 4.2%, as low as it's been since just before the pandemic. Like I said, two different surveys. Fortunately, we have Kate Davidson here from Politico and Heather Long at The Washington Post to help sort it all out. Hello, you two.
Hey, Amy.
Happy Friday.
So, Heather, first, let's talk about that payrolls number, 210,000 jobs, when economists were expecting more than twice that. Why do you think the big miss?
I certainly said, oh, my, when I first saw that number. It's so low, and certainly more weak hiring, and we lost jobs in retail and lost jobs in nursing homes and lost jobs in daycare. So a lot of those frontline positions are very weak hiring. But as you said, when you that comes from that payroll survey where they're surveying what businesses are reporting to the government. And what's notable about that survey is it's been revised up a lot lately. Remember in September, the first number we got in September was 194,000 jobs, and we were all gasping
right.
and thinking the jobs recovery was over. Well, today we learned the actual number in September was 379,000, so almost double that initial number. So a lot of people, as they dug deeper into this report and they started seeing the household survey where they actually go out and ask people, hey, do you have a job right now? How's it going? What's your pay? So what's showing over a million people found a job in November. So that's a pretty big disparity, 200,000 jobs versus over a million. So that's why a lot of people are thinking that this initial round, they just didn't have all the data in from those business surveys. And that number, that 210,000 number, probably going to be revised higher.
So I want to go a little bit into the retail jobs you mentioned. Those jobs actually declined by 20,000 during a big month for the industry, typically, and, you know, realizing that they might be revised. Kate, I'm wondering what that tells you about the economy right now.
Well, I just think it's a reminder that we just don't know what's going on, right? And I think Heather would probably agree with me. It's just month after month, it's not just with the jobs report. We see this with a lot of economic data that economists' expectations and what we think we know or expect is going to happen is just kind of turned on its head. And So I think, as I guess Fed Chairman Jay Powell said, it's good to be humble right now. And I think that today there are certainly a lot of people trying to figure out what's going on. But like Heather said, when you sort of step back and you look at the trends, you look at what's been happening over several months, you look at participation numbers, how many people are coming back in, there's definitely some clear signs of improvement. This is still a very strong labor market. There's some pieces of these reports that are a little bit confusing, and it will take time, I think, to figure out what's happening there. But overall, I would say there's definitely still encouraging information that we got today.
Yeah. So Heather, talk about labor participation, which did grow significantly, including for women, and unemployment is down to 4.2%. How close would you say we are to full employment right now?
Ooh, that is a dangerous question. How close to full employment? I think you got to kind of discount the unemployment rate at the moment because we still have, depending upon how you calculate it, you know, 3.9 million jobs that were lost during the pandemic that aren't back yet. And if you, you know, some economists say that number should be closer to 5 million or even 6 million. million because we would have kept adding jobs had there not been a pandemic. So there's still a lot more people to get back into the workforce, both women and men. But I, you know, overall, this was hugely encouraging sign in November. We saw a big surge of people returning to look for jobs and moving from unemployed to employed during November, at least if you base it on that household survey that had a lot rosier numbers. I'm still optimistic. I will say my two big worries. Number one, we're still missing 1.5 million women who dropped out of the labor force and haven't come back yet. A lot of those are women of color still struggling with those childcare issues. And number two, the other one that I'd keep screaming about, I don't think we could say enough about, daycare and bus drivers. Daycare still down 10% compared to pre-pandemic staffing levels, and school buses are down 20% compared to pre-pandemic. Until we get some of that stuff stabilized, I don't think we have a full recovery.
And a lot of the jobs that women that tend to be occupied by women didn't perform as well last month, right? Like healthcare and education jobs that tend to be dominated by women.
Yeah, that's right.
Sorry, Amy. this is Kate. I wasn't sure whether Heather was going to jump in on that one, but I would say, I mean, I think, like I just keep telling people as a mom, I brace myself, you know, every week for that email from school saying, oh, you know, there's been a case in your child's classroom. They have to come home and work from home. And I just have to imagine that's such a big factor for a lot of women in the workforce right now. I think policymakers clearly expected that there was going to be a big burst of people, of women, especially mothers, coming back to the workforce in September when schools reopen. But they still have this unpredictability, right, of scheduling. If you don't know whether there are going to be cases, and definitely there have been, you know, it's been encouraging that I don't think there have been a lot of big, you know, COVID breakthroughs or you know, outbreaks rather in schools. I don't think that that's a source of contagion really, but there are random cases that are happening, and that just makes it hard, I think, for women to plan, having that predictability of scheduling to be able to go back to full-time work.
So, Kate, I want to switch gears real quickly before I let you go, which over to Congress, which averted a shutdown last night with another short-term spending bill. But there's another big deadline coming up, right? The debt ceiling. The U.S. could default as early as December 21st, according to a new projection by the Bipartisan Policy Center. Any progress there?
Yeah, so we know that Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer have been having very quiet negotiations, and that's generally a good sign. If they're not out there on the Senate floor yelling at each other, it sort of means that they're making some progress behind the scenes, but they're keeping it very close to the vest. We don't know what their strategy is going to be. We heard some rumblings this week that they might try and attach something to this defense spending bill. You know, lawmakers rarely want to vote just on the debt ceiling. It needs to be attached to something that lawmakers have an incentive to vote for, just to make it more palatable. They don't like to vote for something that looks like they're increasing debt. So there's not that many more legislative options for them before they go home for the holidays. So I think it's going to be, we have to hear something over the coming week about how they're going to deal with this, or things could start to get a little dicey as we get closer to the holidays.
All right, we got to leave it there. Kate Davidson with us from Politico, Heather Long from The Washington Post. Thank you both so much. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, a rocky end to a rocky week. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We talked about the decline in retail jobs in November. Well, speaking of muddled, some industries that support retail added jobs, namely transportation and warehousing. Those sectors added 50,000 workers in November and now employ over 200,000 more people than before the pandemic. Marketplace's Justin Ho looked into warehouse employment and whether those jobs have staying power.
At the start of last month, Greg Warwick started leasing a warehouse for the baking equipment supply company he runs, called TMB Baking. He says given how challenging it is to import the products he sells,
we need to increase the amount of our goods available to our customers so that they can have the equipment when they need it.
Warwick says he's also hiring a full-time employee to help manage the warehouse and prep items for shipment. He says that position is here to stay.
If our strategy is to take on additional space, to have more product, then we need to ensure that we can also continue to move that through.
For other companies, a lot of the transportation and warehousing jobs added last month were only seasonal hires, says Jason Miller, a professor of supply chain management at Michigan State University. That said, warehouse employment has been one of the fastest growing sectors of the job market since 2019.
We're not going to see a sudden massive decline in warehousing employment once we get to the other side of the pandemic.
But for workers, warehousing roles tend to be physically demanding. Catherine Zekier at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth says the positions can have unpredictable hours and higher rates of injury.
Even if the total number of jobs increases in these sectors, the jobs themselves might be far from stable from the workers' perspective.
As a result, she says, the warehousing jobs may stick around, but they're likely to have a lot of turnover. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
. 2021 has been a pretty good year for the natural gas industry. The price of gas has come down recently thanks to forecasts of a warmer than expected winter here in the U.S., but it's still up almost 80% for the year, in large part because of strong demand overseas. And those higher prices are spurring energy companies to gobble up more drilling rights, often in communities where fossil fuel extraction has become the local economy's lifeblood. Marketplace's Andy Euler has this dispatch from Northwest Louisiana.
Every Tuesday at 2 in the afternoon, a group of women meets at the 4C Coffee House in Grand Cane, Louisiana, population 242. The village in DeSoto Parish is about half an hour south of Shreveport. 80-something Marsha Richardson is its mayor and sort of presides over the group.
When I was 8 years old, my dad came out of the service, and he did not want to be anywhere around a lot of people. And he found Grand Cane, and there weren't a lot of people here.
He bought some land that he could farm.
Well, in the 40s, when we first moved here, it was cotton. And then dairy farming took over.
Richardson says at one time there were over 100 family-owned dairy farms in the area. There are now zero. In the 1980s, the federal government started buying out farmers here. A lot of them just left town.
All of this was, I call it forgotten land.
Forgotten until about 15 years ago. That's when oil and gas companies decided it was worth their while to drill into the Haynesville Shale that's about 10,000 feet beneath the town. Landmen started knocking on doors and offering big paydays in exchange for the rights to drill on people's land.
It was a big boost for individuals and for the community because we had acreage and you leased it and got money. I called it free money. We didn't earn it, we just received it.
The village leased some of its land and used the money to update its water and drainage system, and the local economy bounced back.
Right now is the first time in my entire life that I've seen every business on this street occupied, every single one.
John Franklin's family's owned land in DeSoto Parish for six generations.
56 years old, it's never happened in my life. Never.
In an area where the median household income is just over $25,000, many local landowners who signed away their mineral rights got five- and six-figure checks up front. On top of that, every month, many get checks for the gas that's extracted. In Franklin's case, that adds up to more than he makes from the cattle and timber that he sells. And this year's spike in gas prices means he's earning even more. Oil and gas companies are scrambling to buy up even more mineral rights in DeSoto Parish. Brad Williams is the president of Spitfire Energy Advisors in Houston.
I think today we are in a period of enthusiasm with high prices for natural gas. So producers see that, lenders and investors see that.
Williams says natural gas prices are up in part due to demand from overseas as countries move away from coal and oil to generate electricity.
The World Bank is refusing to finance new coal projects. They will finance a natural gas power generation project.
U.S. producers are aiming to supply that demand by exporting liquefied natural gas, or LNG.
Vietnam canceled like 20 coal units and is now looking at replacing those with natural gas power generation. Well, that LNG is going to come from someplace.
Some of it from DeSoto Parish. But for all that money that gas boom has brought to small towns like Grand Cane, it's come at a cost.
Although many of these companies have developed good protocols for fracking, there are cases in which there's been significant environmental damage.
Sally Fleming's a local lawyer who's filed multiple class action lawsuits against oil and gas companies, including in DeSoto Parish, where one fracking accident released benzene into the water table. But she's also sold mineral rights on some of her land.
As a person who's receiving money that I didn't earn, you know, I'm very grateful for it. And if we're responsibly producing natural gas and making sure that there are no fugitive emissions and not having a fracking accident like we had in DeSoto, I think there's, you know, some significant potential there.
Grand Cane Mayor Marsha Richardson isn't all that worried about the oil and gas industry degrading the environment. She has active oil and gas leases on the land that her father left her.
In our area, the companies that have had them have really handled whatever I call the byproduct very well. We've not suffered any here at all, and there are people fuss and holler about the noise, but it was kind of like back when we were in the dairy business and they fussed about the smell. It just smelled like money to me, and all that cracking noise sounds like money to me, too. So.
She says the people working on these newly drilled rigs spend a lot of money at local businesses. And with the next round of cash from the village's leases, she's hoping to update Grand Cane's sewer system. In DeSoto Parish, Louisiana, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It was like they had just won the lottery.
One can always dream. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 59 points, a tenth of a percent, to finish at 34,580. The NASDAQ shed 295 points, 1.9%, to end at 15,085. And the S&P 500 was down 38 points, 0.8%, to land at 4,538. For this volatile week, the Dow lost 0.9%, the NASDAQ shed 2.6%, and the S&P fell 1.2%. A week where the Omicron variant dominated economic news, vaccine makers are trying to figure out if their current offerings protect against it. So as the week draws to a close, Moderna shot up 1.7%, Pfizer boosted 2.3%, Johnson & Johnson added 1.4%. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.35%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Okay, back to jobs and where they get done. For a lot of workers, it's not going to be the office anytime soon. Yesterday, Google told employees it's postponing its return to office plans, along with a new hybrid work model yet again, because of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. Depending on how contagious and dangerous it proves to be, other employers could follow suit. And while some workers may be happy to put off commuting a little longer, for others, the wait and the uncertainty are getting old. Marketplace's Matt Levin has that one.
No matter how much you love your partner, it's tough to spend all day with them. So remote worker couples find time for themselves, a jog outdoors, a few hours with a book. Or if you're Andy Deal, a research analyst for the College of Western Idaho.
I actually picked up a job at Pizza Hut delivering pizza, so I had a reason to leave the house 4 hours a night, four nights a week.
He delivered pizzas, not for the money, but for some time alone. Deal stopped moonlighting when the office reopened in June. He's now hybrid, 3 days a week in, two at home. He loves it.
The switching back and forth works for me. It also means that every day is a little different.
Sure, plenty of remote workers want to stay fully remote forever, but plenty also desperately want a hybrid arrangement, or at the very least, a clear plan from their boss, says Adam Galinsky, a professor at Columbia Business School.
The ping-ponging of office reopenings is going to have a huge impact on the morale of staff because one of the core human needs is a sense of control and predictability.
Galinsky cautions companies against overhyping reopening dates and says they should have a clear contingency plan if something goes awry. Johnny Taylor Jr. at the Society for Human Resource Management says CEOs should prepare for a future of constant adaptation.
This isn't going to be the last variant. And so we had better, as executives, learn not to freak out every time there's a new announcement.
Andy Deal, the college research analyst, he's not freaking out about Omicron yet, but if things shut down again, he's always got Pizza Hut. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
We talked earlier about some of the jobs more likely to be done by women. It wasn't all that long ago that certain jobs just weren't available to us, including in professional sports. In a new book called Hail Mary, sports writers Lindsay D'Arcangelo and Brittany De La Creta tell the story of the National Women's Football League. That's American football, by the way. And in its heyday in the 1970s, it was the only pro sports league for women in the country. Here's Lindsay D'Arcangelo.
The women who played in the NWFL were incredible. They did it simply for the love of the sport. They got paid next to nothing. Some teams that had owners, they would get paid $25 a game before taxes. Other teams that were started by women and run by women themselves had to raise their own money through car washes and making bumper stickers and things of that nature, had barely enough money to go from game to game, let alone give themselves their own stipend. They were single, they were married, they had kids, they had jobs, they were thin, they were fat, they were tall, they were short, they were all different types of races. Just think of this melting pot, right, of women who had this one singular goal to get the opportunity to play football, and they took it. I did get a chance to see the LA Dandelions play the Dallas Blue Bonnets in a on a DVD that one of the players sent to me.
This is what is meant by a professional football powerhouse.
It's just incredible. I mean, it's live game action, and these women couldn't care less. I mean, about like throwing each other to the ground. They were like face mask penalties, and you're watching football. You know, it's every element that we love to watch about football, an interception run back for a touchdown, or just a handoff to the left side of the field where the running back just runs or gets to the outside and breaks down the field, runs over a few people. And what I love, though, is every time one of these women scored a touchdown, it was like they had just won the lottery. They the way they celebrated, how thrilled they were. You just saw the joy in watching them play. You can't grow a league if nobody knows about it. But you also have to remember that these sports departments and these papers at the time were run by men. So they deemed what was worthwhile to cover, and women's football was not one of those things. It didn't succeed. No, but it left a legacy, an incredible legacy. I do believe that we see the WNBA and the National Women's Soccer League and other leagues that are trying to get established. I see the roots of that in the NWFL. They did it first. They broke down that barrier in a big way, and it deserves to be remembered and recognized.
That was Lindsay D'Arcangelo, co-author of the new book, Hail Mary. This final note on the way out today, one company that saw a big increase in demand early in the pandemic was DocuSign, you know, the electronic signature company. Well, its stock fell more than 40% today after the company said that after 6 quarters of accelerated growth, customers were returning to more normalized buying patterns, as in meeting face-to-face to sign stuff. All right, we are out of here after your moment of economic context. As a look ahead to next week, next Friday, the Consumer Price Index numbers come out for November, better known as how much you are paying for things and what inflation exists in the economy. And I say all of that to bring up one more thing in that jobs report today. Over the past 12 months, average hourly earnings were up 4.8%. As of the last CPI, overall prices, including food and energy, we're up 6.2%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fregali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. And I'm Amy Scott. Have a good weekend. We'll be back on Monday. This is APM.